Okay, Jema. So once again, we are with Essays on the Gita. And just to reorient ourselves, though it is not a sloka by sloka commentary, yet it is a sloka by sloka commentary. And what I mean by that is, though it is written in the freestyle form of essays, all the slokas are there in the Essays on the Gita. So it's not like one has to read Essays on the Gita and then go back and see if something has been missed. Nothing, not even half a sloka has been missed. Then what is the advantage? The advantage is normally when we read any scripture, there is a context, a background, there is a language, and there is a tendency nowadays, every time there is a tendency to read the scripture from word to word, to understand the meaning of the words. But as we know that even when we understand a language very well, we often miss the meaning in our even normal conversation. Because the consciousness that is moved to speak and act is very different. So when it comes to a scripture like the Gita or the Vedas, the Upanishads, it's so much more difficult. Because we are in contact with Sri Krishna's immeasurable consciousness. And there is so much which is held back, especially given that the Gita is given during the in the contingency of a battlefield, and Sri Krishna has to probably rapidly summarize a whole world which he pours in the Gita. So what I love especially about Essays on the Gita is that it brings out those little suggestions. Also, it's poetry. Poetry is full of suggestions. And any amount of words analysis, unless you know the heart of Krishna or identified with him, misses the point. And that's the beauty that Sri Aurobindo, as we know, had not only a close contact but an identity with Sri Krishna. So Essays on the Gita carries a much more special meaning. So this is the background, and we see it very clearly in some of the chapters. Say chapter 15 is still continuing, and he has given an interesting name, The Fullness of Spiritual Action. This is the chapter we are going to read. So, chapter 16 of part 2, The Fullness of Spiritual Action. So, what is it meaning? What is Sri Aurobindo trying to reveal to us? Because fullness implies there is something called as a spiritual action, but it's not the full spiritual action. By default, it implies that, and that's exactly what Sri Aurobindo is trying to reveal to us. And here we have to just quickly run through. We are on page 450. The chapter begins on 450. But as always, we'll pick up some lines from here and there. So the background is, up till now, what has been covered? The problem of the Gita is about the problem of action. Arjun is faced with conflicting standards. As a Kshatriya, he must fight the battle. But what a battle, and what the consequences are going to be. This is not ordinary battle. This may involve the destruction of the all those who are loved and dear, maybe destruction of the entire clan, more or less. So there is a conflict within him, whether he should fight or he should not fight. This is the first conflict. So the Gita starts from there, and we should never forget this background. So Sri Krishna tells him that before anything else, you must first get knowledge. Obviously, whatever one wants to do, whether one wants to act or one does not want to act, it should be based on the background of knowledge. And since ordinary knowledge is unable to help us, because Arjun has the ordinary knowledge of, you know, moral duties, social duties, but there is something else required that is not able to solve his dilemma. So Sri Krishna speaks of spiritual knowledge, and therefore he describes two kinds of actions which are possible to a man, a human being. One is action without the knowledge, which is completely based on the ordinary conceptions of life. I should do this, I shouldn't do this, good and bad, etc. Which is okay, but it comes within the domain of the gunas. You continue to act under the impulsion of nature, you are a bound person, you are not free. Even the highest moral ethical idea does not set us free. It can create a stage for being free, that's all, at the most. So this is one kind of action where we are driven by the mind, certain conceptions of the mind, maybe the highest conceptions of mankind at that point of time. But they are still mental conceptions, and since mind is in ignorance, the person remains in ignorance. So this is one kind of action. Second kind of action is where by the process of yoga, Sankhya and other things that Sri Krishna reveals, the soul becomes free and the action continues. Now this also is action, but it is, you have risen above the gunas. So if the consciousness is above the gunas, it is not compelled to act under the stress of the gunas, and yet it acts. How does it act? It acts according to the mechanical continuity of the past sanskara. I act in a certain way because that's my nature. But I am not my nature, therefore I am free. That's the whole logic. That, well, that's how nature operates, and therefore I am compelled to act in a certain way, maybe a sattvic way, rajasic way, but inwardly I am free. So this is what is above the gunas, trigunatit. Ordinarily, that's the explanation, traditional understanding of the Gita. The problem is that when we interpret this way, then the next logical conclusion is nature will act until its old impulsion is exhausted. You are not creating any fresh impulsions. You have no desires, no ego-driven mechanisms. So after some time, action begins to slow down. And after some time, there is a tendency towards quiescence, not only inner but outer quiescence. And there is a tendency to withdraw. So that's how there are commentators who justify sannyas on the basis of the Gita. They say Gita is showing us the path to freedom through action. But you have attained the freedom, then you don't need to act. This is the problem. So, but Sri Krishna insists, no, you have to act, because this doesn't solve his problem. Then he says, sir, you have bypassed my question. My question is, what should I do? Now with this knowledge, you are bypassing my question. You are simply saying, act in knowledge. Action will continue. Maybe 8th day, 9th day, he arrives at Brahmic sthiti. So Arjun says, done. My role is over. I am nothing, nobody, and I am out. So that's not the answer of the Gita, because the whole action is true. The whole field, the kshetra, is the field for the evolving soul. There is a manifestation going on. So then the Gita takes us to the third point. Why would such a person act? He has no more any desire. So Sri Krishna tells him he would act for the good of the people. But here it is march of mankind, lok sangraha, to carry the march of mankind forward. He has no personal motive. And yet he acts because the mankind is moving towards a great consummation. Now all this the Gita doesn't bring out, like, you know, what is the lok sangraha, and it is subject to interpretation. So there are people who may say, well, when I am giving food to the orphanages, I am helping the mankind. But that's not what Gita is saying. Because that is not the problem of Arjun either. Because then the solution would be, okay, you do things which are goody-goody things for the good of mankind. But don't engage in battle. That would be the logical conclusion. So that doesn't serve Arjun's query. So what is the next thing? So next thing is where Gita brings out that beyond this movement where we are ignorantly engaged, and beyond the Brahmic condition in which one is impersonal, vast, universal, free, there is a third poise, and that is the Purushottama. So there is the secret of the entire truth. There we get the entire truth. So what is the truth there? That Purushottama holds within himself the Brahman, impersonal Brahman. But Purushottama also has a divine personality, a divine nature. And it is this nature which, through the veil of ignorance, is trying to push into this world. And ordinarily, he pushes it by swabhava and swadharma of the jiva. So he pushes from deep within the heart, where he is moving everybody and everything. So one feels a deep inspiration, a deep urge to do something from the depths of the heart. And one does it. And not because of any desire or ambition. Many people, I'm sure, sitting here have come that way. I was listening to a wonderful story of Chandramani, how he came. Everybody, how they come. So something deep within, it's not logical. It is something else which from deep within pushes you to act. So this is one where he is acting through the swabhava and swadharma. Is this the whole truth? No, this also is not the whole truth. Because when you act under Swabhava and Sudharma, you are still limited by the Sattva, Rajas, Tamas. So what is the fullness? So now fullness would mean that the whole divine nature, Sri Krishna's own nature which he has hinted, the soul and human nature should be able to embody that. But that is something the Gita doesn't fully reveal. It only suggests. So the fullness of spiritual nature action would mean first we should be free from ignorance. That is fundamental requirement in all yogas, and the Gita also says that. Second is we should continue doing action, not withdraw into some sannyas ashram, because that is what is the demanded of us by the master himself. Not because I am impelled to act mechanically, but I should continue the action. Third is, now this action should lift closer and closer to express the divine will and not my will. Because my will is gone, so it should express the divine will. And fourth, in its expression of the divine will, when it enters into the gunas, it still gets limited. Because we have, the gunas automatically will limit you. So that's where can these guna be changed into something else? That's where this chapter stops. A very beautiful chapter. It reads like a spiritual action thriller. Because step by step he's taking us that, what is the full possibility of spiritual action? And that we have the living example of course, Sri Krishna in the past, but Sri Aurobindo and the mother. Fullness of spiritual action. And to give just one example from the mother's life before we read. So mother used to play tennis. So one can play tennis. Many people play tennis. They play tennis to win, lose, whatever, get a cup, medal. Well, that's not what she is doing. So then she is liberated inside. She starts tennis at 70 again. So why she is playing the tennis? So ordinarily it may be, well, she wants to keep the body healthy and, she was used to tennis, so she is playing. But she is not attached to tennis because she is not playing to win a game. She is inwardly free. No. Mother reveals the secret. When Nirodha for quite some time didn't go to see the tennis, though, sometimes he used to play, but for some time mother didn't ask him to join and he didn't get a chance. So mother asked him, why you didn't come? So he says, mother, what is the use? Because I don't get to play. Then mother reveals. She says, you know what? With each stroke of the ball, I am removing many of your karmas. Now you see how this acts. This is not just a sentiment. It's very simple because this is the full spiritual action taking place. It's not just a tennis ball being hit. That tremendous energy, that tremendous force, divine force which she is embodying is being released all around. And imagine anywhere, anyone sitting there in that influence. What is going to happen? It will wash away things. Simply, whether you know tennis, you don't know tennis, you are sitting there and that tremendous force is being released. So this is the spiritual action in all its fullness. She is playing tennis as a free person, but not playing only to keep the body fit. It's a spiritual action. So that's what we see here. Page 450. And Shubindu reminds us few lines below on the very first page. Its initial object, that is of the Gita, its initial object was not precisely to propose a way of liberation, moksha, but rather to show the compatibility of works with the soul's effort towards liberation and of spiritual freedom itself. When once attained with continued action in the world, muktasya karma. This he has already shown in the previous chapter. Basically it says that, well, Arjuna is worried that I'll incur sin. He is afraid that, this ghor work, this terrible battle, I will incur sin. And he gives nice logic. And Sri Krishna says, you can act in perfect freedom without incurring any sin or any repercussion or reactions. And he will explain in this chapter the logic. If you do action under the stress of the ego, you take the consequences. If the ego is gone and the action is done as a flow from the divine or a command of the divine, or even if you are freed from the ego, there are no consequences. So that's how the law of karma operates, which Sri Krishna reveals in the passing. So this original difficulty is already resolved by saying that, well, you can be inwardly free. But page 451, the last line on this passage, to live, so what is his solution? To live inwardly, calm, detached, silent in the silence of the impersonal and universal self, and yet do dynamically the works of dynamic nature, and more largely, to be one with the eternal within us, and to do all the will of the eternal in the world, expressed through a sublimated force, a divine height of personal nature, of the personal nature, uplifted, liberated, universalized, made one with God nature. This is the Gita's solution. So, and that made the difference. So as the story goes, after the war is over, so as is the custom, the sarathi has to come down first. Like here also, you know, the driver comes down, he opens the door. So logically, Krishna should come down, then Arjun should come down. But Krishna insists Arjun that you come down. He says, why are you changing the rules? He says, no, I make my rules. So Arjun is hesitating because he is too much into norm and form. And then Krishna pushes him. So he comes down. And then as Krishna jumps, the thing goes in flames. There are several stories in the Mahabharata which describe this fullness of spiritual action. And then he says that it was because of his strength, his power, that all this was kept safe. And that lovely story where suddenly when Karna and Arjuna are having a mortal combat, then once he keeps praising, Krishna keeps praising Karna. He says, how lovely. He says, what? He has pushed my rath, chariot, just a few yards behind. And you are saying lovely. Didn't you notice I had hit his chariot with such a force that his chariot went back a few hundred yards behind. And you didn't say a word. Then Krishna says, my strength is with you. Don't forget. So you are not fighting this battle. You are fighting. He is a great warrior. But now it is my energy and force which is pouring into you. Now that brings, heightens not only the capacity, quality, everything. It changes the whole aspect of action. It's the same action. But because it is informed now with the greater consciousness, the divine consciousness, it changes. So that's what we see here described. Same page, last two lines. For to withdraw from his work, to take refuge in a saintly inactivity and leave the imperfect world with its unsatisfying methods and motives to take care of itself is one possible solution, easy to envisage, easy to execute. But this is the very cutting of the knot that has been insistently forbidden by the teacher. Basically meaning thereby, world is going on, it's a bad thing, it needs laundry, but I don't want to be the laundry boy. I am saintly, I'll do nice things, but somebody will do it. It's like I want to keep my hands clean. I don't want to, you know, face the difficulty. I will sit quietly in a, you know, it's the same story that sage Agastya is sitting behind, but Rama is right on the battlefield. So I will sit behind and do deeds, like many saints do this. They say, yes, we understand, but we are doing, we'll pray, we'll meditate, we'll you know, do nice deeds. But what about Operation Sindoor? That soldier has to do. So here Sri Krishna says, no, that's not the solution. If you are on the battlefield, you can't take recourse to being a little saint and continue to act, but in a saintly way. Everybody will say, what a wonderful saint. And you have helped by your prayers. So this is where the whole thing comes. Again, action is demanded of man by the master of the world. Again, to abandon this particular action as evil would be another kind of solution, the ready resort of the short-sighted moralizing mind. But to this evasion too, the teacher refuses his assent. And that's why we see people who say that, you know, Sri Aurobindo went away. No, Sri Aurobindo was constantly engaged in action. Only his method was different. He didn't say that, well, war is bad, therefore I'll stay behind. Some of his disciples went into the world war. And Sri Aurobindo himself, you know, stood behind these forces which were seeking freedom, even through revolution. Absolutely, he was very much behind them. But since he had a much larger work to do, therefore he was in Pondicherry, where it was his seat. Like Krishna on the battlefield, didn't shoot an arrow, but he was very much the soul of the battle. Okay. Again, last line on this passage. What is being Arjuna asked? He must act impersonally and universally in a high union of his soul with the inner and outer Godhead, yukta, in a calm yoga with his own supreme self and the informing self of the universe. So very clearly, this is what Arjuna is being called upon to do, and it's not easy. So we see on the same page that this is a truth of the spirit. This is an action from a spiritual basis. Same page. A spiritual, not an intellectual knowledge is the indispensable requisite for this way of works. So what he means is that you can't therefore do anything and everything saying that, well, Sri Krishna has said you must act whatever is given to you. You must act. Then again I am falling prey to the same old folly. I am acting ignorantly. You have to be surrendered completely to the divine and act under the divine impulsion. First, therefore, the teacher points out that all these ideas and feelings which trouble, perplex and baffle Arjuna, joy and sorrow, desire and sin, the mind's turn towards governing action by the outward results of action, the human shrinking from what seems terrible and formidable in the dealings of the universal spirit with the world are things born of the subjection of our consciousness to a natural ignorance. So how will we will know whether we are free from ignorance or not? There are inner signs, positive signs. Positive signs are the inner calm, equanimity, a state of inner desirelessness, no push and pressure of the ego. The other signs are absence of restlessness, absence of reactions which come. If something is making me restless and I want to do it, if I don't do it, I feel very restless. Or if I am moved by things like anger and all, I can't take refuge in saying it is spiritual action. Then I am still in the kindergarten. It's good to know I am in the kindergarten so that I have to be freed. That the first necessity. Then one continues the yoga action, but does it basically to arrive at the inner calm and freedom. That's the way of karma yoga. So one must found self-knowledge before one can have the basis of the right world knowledge. Okay, page 453, the new passage starts with, the first requisite is to shake the wings of the soul free from desire and passion and troubling emotion and all this perturbed and distorting atmosphere of human mind and arrive into an ether of dispassionate equality, a heaven of impersonal calm, an egoless feeling and vision of things. So the first practice is that, well, enter into that state of deep inner calm, impersonality, universality, equality, desirelessness. That's the practice of the Karma Yoga, which will go on for years, maybe nearly a lifetime. Yes, that's it. So to take that, well, Gita says so, therefore I'll do whatever I feel like. I'll give a dharna, I'll protest, I'll, you know, pick up a sword and have a fight. This is all nonsense. This is not. So people talk nowadays about spiritual activism. But what they mean is that I am doing activism for a spiritual cause. No, that's let's be clear. It's ignorance. Fine, ignorant action is ignorant action. One is entitled to do it. But one should know it is not a spiritual action. It is still an ignorant action. So he tells us the first requisite, and it leads to an equal, impartial, universal presence and support of creation. One experiences that a witnessing consciousness that suffers nature to work out the becoming of things in their own type, swabhava, but does not involve and lose itself in the action she initiates. Meaning thereby, one does the action and one passes by. One is not thinking, oh, did I do the right thing or I did the wrong thing? What did people say? Did they appreciate me? What is going to be the consequences? Now, a spiritually free person goes through the action according to the swabhava and he moves on. There may be repercussions which may be pleasurable, pleasant, or it may be painful. He is free because he has acted according to his swabhava. This one thing, as we said, according to the story of Bhima, Bhima says that to Gandhari, if you had 200 sons, I would have killed them, all of them, without a stain. He says, that's my swabhava. If I see injustice, I am going to. He's acting under swabhava. He doesn't want anything personally. He didn't want the kingdom. He didn't want to usurp any. He says, that's my swabhava. I'm acting by my swabhava. It's nothing to do with you. I have no grievance against you. But these fellows have done something. It's my nature because I am Vayuputra. I'm going to make them fly away. So this is according to swabhava. And in that, the ego of action disappears because you are moved by something much greater. If ego comes, then it's dangerous. Like, as long as Napoleon was acting under the impulsion of Mahakali, it was wonderful. But the day he started thinking that I'm France and France is me, he collapsed, because that's where you have to understand the line is very thin and one has to be always on the watch. Page 454, some 10-15 lines below. The soul that lives in this impersonality is not affected by the actions of which our nature is an instrument. It does not reply to them or their effects by grief and joy, desire and shrinking, attraction and repulsion, or any of the 100 dualities that draw and shake and afflict us. And it applies even to divine action, divinely driven action, mother's work, as we say. If you have to glorify yourself or expect people to appreciate you, then, I mean, it's not about outwardly. Appreciation, that need may be very subtle. It may be, oh, see, I'm doing such a nice work. Then it's not. It's tainted action. One has to go on perfecting till there is no trace of I. It should be pure impersonality. So, last three lines on this passage. If we can live in this equal self, we too are at peace. Our works continue so long as nature's impulsion prolongs itself in our instruments. But there is a spiritual freedom and quiescence. So there the nature is acting in its own way. One is doing whatever one was doing, continues to do, but inwardly one is free. So this is the state, first step. And this is what is regarded as the duality between Purusha and Prakriti. But here you arrive at through works, not through pure jnana of trying to discern, nor through bhakti where the Lord is everything for you, but through karma. So the work, you are continuing to work, but by practice of nishkam karma, we have read that earlier, desireless action without fruits, practice of equanimity, practice of offering the work to the divine, doing it for the sake of the divine, being vigilant and conscious that where is the ego coming through front door, back door, side door, crevices, nooks, crannies. One should be very careful of people who appraise you. Huh? One should be... Flatterers are dangerous. Because they are digging a well for you. People who criticize are at least doing good to you. That's how one saint has said, keep them near you. They will never let your ego get puffed up. But those who flatter are dangerous, because you may start believing them. And then you won't know that a hole is being dug for you. One day they will push you inside it. So this is the duality, and this has been explained in various ways, that this duality doesn't give the final answer. So the answer is that just as there is a soul which is involved in ignorance and the lower nature, there is a true soul which is in the Purushottama with the divine and with this true divine nature. So this is the Vaishnava solution, that one day you can go there. The Jivatma dwells in Vaikuntha or Vrindavan or Golok. There it puts on the divine nature. But there, not here. So you are happy. This what is described in House of the Spirit and the New Creation. That the soul which has not fallen, in the Life Divine it described in the chapter, the divine soul. So there is a status of the soul in which it has not fallen or got involved into this ignorance of lower nature. So you can arrive at that status. So there is this involved part and lower nature, you are out. Then you are in the divine nature, in the company of the divine, in a divine world, which is wonderful. But that's not what Sri Aurobindo and Sri Krishna want, because he's asking him to again fight in a very gory battle. So this context again and again comes to the mind. This is important because, well, Arjun will say that I can arrive in any way. Why you want me to fight the battle? Because it doesn't solve the riddle. Okay, I'll do puja, I'll do some good deeds, I'll do charity, I'll join the Red Cross, I'll open an NGO, I'll teach people archery, and eventually I'll go into, you know, your lok where I will be happy with you, putting on the divine nature. That's why in Savitri, you see, it's very interesting. After book 3, canto 3, comes book 3, canto 4. So he has seen the status of the soul which has not suffered a fall. See the description, you know, what feeling is, what thought is, each soul's divine nature. And the Divine Mother knows and that he doesn't want this. He wants it to be embodied there. And that's why she starts telling, what thou hast won is thine, but ask no more. No soul is thy companion in the light. So that is the Vaishnava solution, to be in a Chinmay body, a conscious body or a body of bliss, whatever it is, and dwell there. So that's not, Sri Aurobindo says very clearly, that's not the solution that Sri Krishna is asking us, because naturally if that was the case, he would have said, okay Arjun, I get your point, but see, action is important. You don't want to fight the battle, no big deal. You do one thing, start nearby an NGO. Take care of things. I have no choice. I have to clean up this dirty linen, so I'll do it with some other instrument. But you have arrived at a high point of development to be able to withdraw from this and do something else. But that's not what the master is demanding of Arjuna. After everything, he again and again says, pick up the bow, pick up the arrow and fight. So that's where the whole problem comes. Page 455. The Gita affirms. So this passage, I've skipped this about the duality and what I just shared of two purushas and two poises of the one purusha and two types of nature. The Gita affirms that there is a supreme mystery, a highest reality that upholds and reconciles the truth of these two different manifestations. So one is the quiescent state and the other is this turbulent fields of nature. There is an utmost supreme self, Lord and Brahman, one who is both the impersonal and the personal, but other and greater than either of them, and other and greater than both of them together. This is something which is so important, both in the Gita and Sri Aurobindo's yoga. Impersonal universality is not the highest truth. There is the Ishwara and the Shakti. That's why our personality can be consumed and sublimated and transformed. If impersonal Brahman is the highest, personality has no meaning. Then love can be a means to arrive there, but having gone there, it should become quiet. Heart has no role. Thought can strive toward that, but having arrived there, gone. That's why somebody asked Sri Aurobindo, people see, nasty question actually if you ask me. that it is said that when, I think it was Dilip Kumar Roy, that it is said that when a person realizes, then he doesn't speak or write, he quotes Sri Ramakrishna. Now you see, Shobindra had the realization and he wrote the pages of the Arya. He is referring to that. And Shobindra says, yes, yes. But Sri Ramakrishna also continued to speak after that, which is a fact. So this idea that you arrive there and then you don't need to speak anything, don't need to write anything, it's not true. Because action has a meaning, but its meaning is not found in the impersonal Brahman, even as it is not found in our striving here. Its meaning lies in the will of the divine will, the Purushottama. That's where he is leading us. He is Purusha, self and soul of our being. But, this but is important, but he is also Prakriti, for Prakriti is the power of the all soul, the power of the eternal and infinite self moved to action and creation. He is the secret push behind Prakriti. In fact, he is original Prakriti in its origin is there. But he is moving it through the, it's like an actor who is acting on the scene. Basically, it's not the actor, it's the director. He has put word. Rarely we see, we enjoy a drama, so we appreciate the actors. Oh, what a dialogue. But dialogue is not his. It is the script writer. It is the director. So what is given to him? He may play it well or not play it well. That's where ignorance comes in. He may, the actor may think, oh, I should not be speaking this dialogue. Can I improvise better? A villain may think, this is projecting me in a bad light. I must do it differently. That's where our role lies. But we are being moved. So lower nature is also moved by the higher super nature. But it gets limited, distorted in the play by, that's what the triple soul forces story is about. On one side, the original impulsion, and on the other side, the impulsion in what distortion takes place in the field of nature. The supreme ineffable, the universal person, he becomes by his prakriti all these creatures, para prakriti jiva bhuta. In fact, his prakriti, not this prakriti, his prakriti has become all these jivas. It is the power, the energy, the consciousness. The supreme Atman and Brahman, he manifests by his maya of self-knowledge and his maya of ignorance, the double truth of the cosmic riddle. This is an interesting thing. He is at once knowledge and ignorance. And why would he do this? So we have the story of Ambubhai. Not Ambubhai Purani, that one. But I think he was also Purani, but I may be mistaken. But the one who used to do these physical exercises, those photographs you will see in Dada's book. So once some people had come from outside, abroad, and they wanted to know something about Madra and Shirobindo and the yoga, and she sent Ambu, you go and talk to them. So he, mother, first of all, they are coming from outside, they have good English and all. You are sending me, I don't even understand well, I can't speak well. Why didn't you send Amal Kiran? He is polished, they will be very impressed when he speaks. This after he gave a talk, he comes back. Mother says, no, no, no. If I send Amal, he will speak from a level where they will not understand anything. Therefore, I sent you because you are just right. You see, ignorance has its own utility. Because everything is not ready. Everyone is not ready. That's why conversion, propaganda have no meaning. So, very clearly, she says, I wanted, in fact, she used the word, your ignorance was very useful. You told them certain asanas, all this, they are very happy. But if Amal Kiran would have gone, he would have nothing less than supermind and overmind. And he would have straight away come to Savitri and they would have said, what is he speaking? Disconnected. So these are stages. So divine uses both knowledge and ignorance, and he transcends both. He is beyond ignorance, but he is also beyond knowledge. That's what is the truth he is revealing to us. The Supreme Lord, master of his force, his Shakti, he creates, impels, and governs All this nature and all the personality, power and works of these innumerable existences. The word personality, power is important because otherwise we tend to, impersonal Brahman means there is actually the personality, just a somehow it has come up by nature casually, I don't know how. But because there is a divine personality, something of that gets reflected here. So that's why the transformation is possible. Each soul is a partial being of this self-existent one, an eternal soul of this all soul, a partial manifestation of this Supreme Lord and his universal nature. All here is this divine, this Godhead, Vasudeva. For by nature and the soul in nature, he becomes all that is, and everything proceeds from him and lives in or by him. So we can't separate. Nature has its own truth. It must embody. That thought is not yet come. But basically there is a divine nature. You can't separate these two. This nature is also getting impelled by the Shakti. We need to understand that. Otherwise, there will always be a disconnect between Purusha and Prakriti. So this is the complete truth. But how does this greater truth modify or how affect the principle of spiritual action? It modifies it to begin with in this fundamental matter, that the whole meaning of the relation of self and soul and nature gets changed. Opens out to a new vision, fills in the blanks that were left, acquires a greater amplitude, assumes it true and spiritually positive or flawlessly integral significance. The world is no longer a purely mechanical qualitative action and determinism of nature. So basically how it changes is that, well, now one is that I was acting because of ego and desire. So now ego and desire are gone, so I'll stay calm. Nature will continue to act. No. This action is impelled originally by the divine who wants to manifest his own self. It's the objectivization of the Lord. That means now comes the meaning that why I should improvise the instruments so that I can express better. You see, when Utadi asked the mother that she got an opportunity to study, to go to England for a couple of years. And she asked the mother, should I go or not? She said, you should go. It will bring wideness. Now, why do you need this? She's already here. Why there's a need to go to get wideness? So that was her way of telling that nature also must expand, must also improve. Otherwise, we have the same old tendency. Even ashram context, one day when I had just come, somebody was telling me this story that I love, you know, asking how did people come. So he was saying he was studying history. And then he asked a very revered person in the ashram that what should I do? He said, if you ultimately have to find the divine, so why do you want to waste time in studying history? He said, I came away. I didn't say anything, but mother would want us to develop the instrument not for egoistic purposes, but so that they can be used. After all, Sri Krishna asked Arjun, go and pray and meditate and receive the Pashupatastra from Shiva. Go to Devlok and get the Divyastra. So, divine will not deny if you want to just, you know, remain as you are. But that is the fullness of spiritual action. Every instrument must be raised to its fullest power. That in Synthesis of Yoga, we have those chapters, no? In Integral Self-Perfection, where he speaks about power of the instruments. So, each of these instruments, the mind may remain just, you know, any other mind and you can realize the divine, but you cannot manifest. But if the mind is powerful, vast, then it can be a much better instrument because ultimately creation is about manifestation. So this is the logic of the full spiritual action. Few lines below. Nature itself is now no inexplicable illusion, no separated and opposite phenomenon, but a movement of the eternal. So this is what we are here to learn. Okay. So we come to page 457 and last five lines. But how is this to be done? Okay, fine. We have understood this part, but how to do it? So first he will repeat few things which he has already. It can be done first by a right spirit in our will of works. That means no more to act because of satisfaction of ambition, ego, desire. These things should get so inbuilt into the system that the system goes on a shutdown. The moment it says, oh, you are acting under a personal desire, shut down. It should get into the system. The seeker has to regard all this action as a sacrifice to the Lord of works, who is the eternal and universal being. That means whenever we are pushed by ego and desire, we should say, no, it has to be only for the mother, by the mother, of the mother. That's it. Somebody once asked me on a personal note, oh, you have so much love for India. If you want, you can become spokesperson of a party. I said, you want to demote me some? If at all, it is them whom I must speak, not any party or for any party or on behalf of any party, however great a party may be. I have my views about parties. But the action should be entirely driven by the divine for the sake of the divine. That's what is sacrifice to the eternal. Not for any other purpose, but for the fulfillment of divine will in the world. That should be the only motive. So he reminds us, page 458, man ordinarily offers his sacrifice openly or under a disguise to his own ego. Even mother's work can be a big ego. Huh? I am doing mother's work. So if you are doing some big work, it's mother's work. If you are so disguise. His oblation is the false action of his own self-will and ignorance. Or he offers his knowledge, action and aspiration, works of energy and effort to the gods for partial temporal and personal aims. So I am doing mother's work, but I am eyeing on the chair. Now everywhere there is a chair somewhere hanging. So I'll become the head somewhere. So eyeing on that. The man of knowledge, the liberated soul, offers on the contrary all his activities to the one eternal Godhead without any attachment to their fruit or to the satisfaction of his lower personal desires. He works for God, not for himself. So equally he is able to leave it the next moment. If the divine wants you to leave, you leave without thinking that, oh, what will happen? The moment you think I am important for the work, if I leave it, work will collapse, then there is a big ego which is sitting there. If you have to leave, you leave. If you are doing, do it as a God-driven instrument. He works for God, not for himself. For the universal welfare, for the soul of the world, and not for any particular object which is of his own personal creation, or for any construction of his mental will, or object of his vital longings. Construction of mental will. This is how I think it should be done. If it is not done like this, then there is a problem. I must be open to the true knowledge. In fact, God works in so many ways, countless ways, simultaneously. And vital longings. If I am there, I must succeed somehow. Because as if you succeed, then the divine has stamped, oh, this was divine work. Not at all. So many examples in history. French Revolution, completely a divine work, but divine action. It collapsed. Did it fail? No, it didn't fail. It took another instrument. Even that instrument collapsed. Napoleon. Still it didn't fail. It continues to reverberate. So divine action doesn't act according to our human ideas. Napoleon was the antithesis of what the French Revolution originally stood for. And yet Napoleon became an instrument for spreading the idea of freedom and, you know, equality as an emperor. And when he was driven by egoism, he also was broken and kept aside. But the idea continued. So this is where we have to understand that, you know, our mental ideas and self-will. Okay. Then the last three lines on this page. But beyond this step, there lies. So first is a sacrifice to the divine for the sake of the divine, not for any self-will, ego, under mental ideas and, you know, vital push, none of these things. But it's a sacrifice to the divine. Second is, but beyond this step there lies that other great motion, the true surrender of all our actions to the divinity within us. For it is infinite nature that impels her works, and a divine will in and above her that demands action of us. The choice and turn our ego gives to it is a contribution of our tamasic, rajasic, sattvic quality, a deformation in the lower nature. The deformation comes by the ego thinking of itself as the doer. So he is saying, what is surrender? Surrender is to give up completely the egoism of the doer. The divine is acting, and he is acting. He could act through any instrument. The character of the act takes the form of the limited personal nature, and the soul is bound up with what and with that and its narrow figures, and does not allow the act to proceed freely and purely from the infinite power within it, because constantly the mind and the vital are distorting that action. And the ego is chained to the act and its outcome. It must suffer the personal consequence and reaction. The free, perfect working comes first by referring and finally by surrendering altogether the action and its origination to the divine master of our existence, for we feel it progressively taken up by a supreme presence within us. That's what we see with Sri Aurobindo from the freedom movement when he withdrew, because he had the command, he withdrew completely. And so many people came, requested him. The then president of the Congress, John Baptista, wrote to him, Hedgewar, others, they came here to ask him to come back. Munje, all great names, but he refused. But that was because he knew now this is the field which is given to him. Completely, it is not like I am indispensable. They said you are indispensable, but Sri Aurobindo knew that now other instruments have to take up what his work was to initiate. Now there are other instruments who have to fulfill it. So this is the Uttamam Rahasya. Page 459. So second is surrender. And what happens when we surrender? Last two lines. This change cannot come about except by knowledge. So there has to be the right knowledge. And why this right knowledge is necessary? Because page 460. We know now what the knowledge is. It is sufficient to remember that it reposes on another and wider vision than the human mental. A changed vision and experience by which one is first of all liberated from the limitations of the ego sense and its contacts, and feels and sees the one self in all in God, all beings as Vasudev, all as vessels of the Godhead, and one self too as a significant being and sole power of that one Godhead. It treats so, spiritual knowledge is oneness. It doesn't say ki I am the only instrument and the way divine is acting within me is the only way he should act in everyone. That's where, you know, fundamentalism, fanaticism, and you know, all the evil, narrowness, intolerance, dogma comes. In me, he manifests this way. But in someone else, he is manifesting in another way. And we have to allow that vastness of impersonality. It allows no wall of separation and lives in a universal sympathy with all existences. While amidst the world movement, one still does the work that has to be done for the good of all. Sarva bhuta hite rata. According to the way appointed by the divine and in the measures imposed by the command of the spirit who is master of time. So you are acting only under the divine impulsion, not for any personal reasons, grudges, preferences, none of these. Thus living and acting in this knowledge, the soul of man becomes united with the eternal in personality and in impersonality. How beautiful this is. Lives in the eternal, though acting in time, even as the eternal acts, and is free, perfect and blissful, whatever may be the form and determination of the work done in nature. And now comes a beautiful word. Krishna Krat. So here he says, the liberated man has the complete and total knowledge. Krishna Vid. And does all works without any of the restrictions made by the mind. Krishna Karma Krat. So mind makes all kinds of restrictions. When Jyoti Priya once told the mother, Judith Tyberg, that, you know, Los Angeles Center, She says, everybody tells me that you are going out and all this. This is, you are going away from the yoga. Once you have taken up yoga, you must stay here only. All this. Mother says, why do you listen to them? You have come for work. If everybody will stay here, who will do my work? This is a letter actually written to Jyotipriya, and it's there on their site. So this idea that, see, this is how the mind, certain works are divine works. For example, if I am working in the ashram or Auroville, this is divine work. But when I am going out to Chennai, it's no more divine work. I can just say hallelujah, whatever I want. That's not true. Every work is part of the same rhythm, movement of the divine. So that makes the whole picture complete. He turns with adoration to the self of whom he is a portion, the master of his works and divine lover of his soul and nature. He is not an impassive, calm spectator only. He lifts not only his knowledge and will to the eternal, but his heart also of love and adoration and passion. For without that uplifting of the heart, his whole nature is not fulfilled and united with God. So what will be the sign, the final sign that you are completely in that union of God and being driven by God is ananda. That's what. Because then even love has got involved. So normally love has, people say, what has this got to do with work? Keep them separate. But actually any work done without love is no work actually. It's a drudgery. So he says, for without that uplifting of the heart, the whole nature is not fulfilled and united with God. The ecstasy of the spirit's calm needs to be transformed by the ecstasy of the soul's ananda. Beyond the personal jeev and the impersonal Brahman or Atman, he reaches the supra-cosmic Purushottama, who is immutable in impersonality and fulfills himself in personality and draws us to him through these two different attractions. So this is where the last step is, the delight of works, the joy that automatically comes. People often complain that I am doing the work but I don't feel joy. That's because heart is not engaged in it. As simple as that. When the heart engages, then every work is a joy. So heart must engage. Whatever work one is doing is not for, even if you say I am doing ashram work, no, it doesn't work. I am doing mother's work. It could be in the ashram or anywhere. Then the heart gets, you know, involved, and that love comes for the love of the mother. So here he takes us to the last question, page 461, somewhere a little below the middle. But while we are here in the body, here in life, here in action, what is this change? What in this change becomes of the lower nature? This has not been taken up, actually, strictly speaking. All this is wonderful. But what happens to this lower nature and the instruments? For at present, all our activities are determined in their trend and shape by the nature. Last five lines from below. For even the man of knowledge, says the Gita, must act according to his nature. To feel and bear the reactions of the gunas in the outer manifestation, but to be free from them and superior in the observing conscious self behind is not sufficient. For it leaves a dualism of freedom and subjection. So basically what Shubhendu is saying, that well, you are aligned now to the divine will. You are acting according to the divine will. But still the lower nature is there. So you are acting under the divine will. Still the lower nature is there, which is limiting the action. It's like you are getting now from the purest source. But your instrument, your capacity, your nature is still limited. You are free from ego, but still, you know, it gets fatigued, it gets tired. And this is a question which the mother once says in Agenda, there is a conversation. Where he says, yes, I know that the Gita says that still you cannot change your nature. Because there is a phrase, how does coercion help? But she says, but I tell you, you can change the nature. So this is something which the mother and Sri Aurobindo bring in. It's not there in the Gita. About the transformation of nature and the transformation of the instruments. So Sri Aurobindo leaves it very beautifully with a question. Last paragraph. This is the difficulty which the Gita has still to meet in order to justify works to the seeker of the spirit. Otherwise, it must say to Arjun, act temporarily in this fashion, but afterwards seek the higher way of renunciation of works. But on the contrary, it has said that not the cessation of works, but renunciation of desire is the better way. It has spoken of the action of the liberated man, muktasya karma. It has even insisted on doing all actions, sarvani karmani, krits karma krat. It has said that in whatever way the perfected yogin lives and acts, he lives and acts in God. Last four lines. How and by what steps is this most difficult transformation to be effected? What is this last secret of the soul's perfection? What the principle or the process of this transmutation of our human and earthly nature? See, interesting. This closes with a question mark. Because this is not there actually in the Gita. He will take us to the next step of Deva and Asura. Sri Krishna knocks at the secret, but he knocks at the secret, but he doesn't quite open the door. So Sri Krishna, Sri Aurobindo says, yes, yes, there is this knock. Because all said and done, if this basically the outer nature is still in the siege of the limitations, the instruments are still limited, everything is fine, but you cannot have the ideal of divine life and a perfected human life upon earth. They will always be in the house of the spirit, the perfect nature, and here an imperfect nature struggling. So that's the project Sri Krishna has taken again in the persona of Sri Aurobindo. So that's what I say. What is the relation between Sri Aurobindo and Sri Krishna? All kinds of things people say. I say Sri Aurobindo is Sri Krishna returning back to fulfill his promise and to complete the unfinished work. Okay. Jai Ma.